Manor Associates versus Michelle, is it Michelle?
Michelle Bast.
Bast. Arguing on behalf of Michelle Bast is Mark A. Silverman of Legal Action of Wisconsin. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Silverman. I'm with Legal Action of Wisconsin. To my right is Larry Dupuis, who was formerly of Legal Action of Wisconsin and has worked on this case extensively. Unlike the case that Your Honors heard this morning, this case doesn't involve much math. Judges have the right to change their minds. That right is codified in Section 805.17 sub 3 of the Wisconsin statutes. The applicability of that section to small claims court is supported by the clear language in the legislation, by case law, and by legislative history. The purpose of Section 805.17 sub 3 is to allow judges to reconsider, either on their own motion or on a motion brought by a party. And what it does is allows the moving party to make that motion to reconsider without the fear of losing his or her time to appeal. What 805.17 sub 3 does is the time to appeal commences when the motion is disposed of, or if the trial judge does not make a decision on the motion within 90 days, then it is considered denied.
But what does this do to the, I would say, I hope I don't want to mischaracterize it, but the general summary nature of the eviction action itself? In other words, as has been argued and looked at, this would extend that time for at least 3 months, perhaps longer.
Your Honor,
doesn't that fly in the face of what 799 and the eviction action is all about?
Your Honor, we believe that the applicability of 805.17 sub 3 actually can speed up the resolution of these proceedings, because without the availability of reconsideration, the litigants must, in every instance, if they want error correction, file an appeal. What this section does is it allows, number one, a judge to reconsider on his or her own motion, but it also allows the party to reconsider and not lose their time to appeal. It is along the policy that this court has announced to encourage error correction in the trial court. So I understand the question. I believe the Court of Appeals felt also that somehow the existence of these motions in small claims court could delay things when, if you didn't have it, you would have appeals all the time.
But you wouldn't you just I'm just trying to digest what you said as far as speeding up things. My reaction would be that, knowing that you have 15 days to appeal, you have 20 days for a motion for reconsideration, I would think it would be almost become standard policy that if you were you lost in the trial court, that you would wait 18 days. You would then move, have a motion for reconsideration, knowing full well that you still then have the opportunity to appeal from that. So I guess that's why I asked the first question.
Yes, Your Honor, what this case does not address is the scenario where a motion to reconsider was filed after the 15th day following the entry of judgment. In this case, it was filed well within the 15 days. There are only, by the way, 15 days is the appeal period from an eviction in small claims court. And in this case, the motion to reconsider was filed, I believe, on the seventh day. This court does not have to address the issue of what happens if those 15 days go by. Can a person file a motion to reconsider and then start the 15 days within which to appeal sometime after those 15 days have already elapsed?
That's my question. Under 805.17.3, it says you have 20 days for a motion to reconsider. So now you have one 15-day period, which is the appeal, and then you have a 20-day. So I was just surmising, isn't there some potential conflict there? And if there is, then it would seem to me that knowing that the decision isn't final, particularly in an eviction, would prolong that, because the judge, he or she has to, you have the motion, you have to put it on your calendar, there is a, you know, all of these things have to occur, and then even after that, then you possibly would want to appeal.
Your Honor, there already is, if you want to use the word, a tension between a 15-day period and a 20-day period within Chapter 799 at Section 799.28. That governs new trials following trials to a jury. And the language in that section is that a motion for a new trial must be made and heard within 20 days after the verdict is rendered. So there you have 20 days, and yet your time to appeal from an eviction is 15 days. So there's no further tension between a 15-day period and a 20-day period as already exists within the statute. This case involves the filing of a motion to reconsider well within the 15 days time limit for appealing. We are not saying that the commencement of the time to appeal is an enlargement of the time to appeal. It's merely when the time commences. In fact, there have been cases that dealt with 805.17(3) enlarged claims cases. Right after the Supreme Court promulgated this rule, 805.17(3), there was a case that dealt with the shortening of the time to appeal from 90 days to 45 days when there has been a notice of entry of judgment served by one party upon the other. The court harmonized. This was the Court of Appeals in Salzman. This case was not included in our brief because this issue really was not addressed by the Court of Appeals.
The 15th citation.
And the citation is 168 with second 523, and that's a Court of Appeals case decided in 1992. And in that case, the Court of Appeals harmonized what the court said was an apparent conflict between 805.17(3) and that statute, which is to speed up the time to appeal in a large claims case. The court said that this harmonization is possible to give full effect to the intent behind both statutes. And what the court did is explain that 805.17(3) merely is the measurement of when the clock, so to speak, starts to tick for the time to appeal. In that case, because it was a large claims case, it was a 45-day clock. In small claims, it's a 15-day clock.
Here's my problem. 805.17(3) deals with, I gather, if you look at the council note, is a reconsideration within 20 days after entry of judgment and an action tried to the court, right?
That's correct.
So it gives you 20 days. 806.07 is relief from a judgment or order, and it gives you a different time period and also gives you criteria or factors to be considered. What's the relationship between these two?
Your Honor,
and then let me just tell you why I'm asking these questions. The Court of Appeals referred to Verhagen, right?
Yes.
In June of 2003, we had State versus Edwards. Verhagen was a civil case. And if I remember it right, and Edwards is a criminal case. And Verhagen said, hey, a motion for reconsideration does not extend the time for taking an appeal. It has to be a new issue. Edwards and Verhagen, when I looked at it very quickly this morning, seemed to be under the old statutes, not the new statute. It's a pretty old case. Edwards relied on Verhagen and distinguished Verhagen, and in my quick reading of Edwards, I don't see under what provision of the statutes the motion for reconsideration was made. So I'm at a quandary to put this together.
Yep.
Verhagen, old statutes, 805.17.3, which you people are relying on, and 806.07, which doesn't seem to be here. So,
right. Your Honor, 806.07, which is in the general rules of procedure,
right,
is supplanted by motions for relief from judgment, which exist within Chapter 799. It's a motion for relief from a default judgment. So
only default judgment.
Only default, and there actually is a case.
All other cases are under 806.07, but defaults?
Because within Chapter 799 there is a statute that, a section that deals with defaults,
right,
then that section, as was held by King versus Moore, that section supplants 806.07 because you have specific language within 799 that applies, and so therefore to reopen a default judgment in small claims court, you only have 6 months. It used to be 90 days, and it was increased to 6 months. And that is actually what happened in King versus Moore, where the Court of Appeals applied what we refer to as the bright line test, where Chapter 799 has a specific provision. In other words, it otherwise provides. Then a similar rule in the general procedural statutes does not apply. Or more simply stated, where Chapter 799 is silent, then the rule in the general procedural statutes does apply.
Mr. Silverman, 806.07 is much broader, a much broader statute than one that is confined to default judgments.
I'm looking at it right now, Your Honor. So the court's question is, since it is much broader than the motion for relief in Chapter 799, is the question, then are there some provisions that do apply because it's not completely supplanted by the Chapter 799 motion for relief from judgment? Is that the question?
The question is, okay, 799 provides for default judgments.
Yes.
Therefore, to the extent there's another provision in the 800s dealing with default, it doesn't apply to small claims. We can accept that. But 806.07 is much broader, and I'm asking you why 806.07 doesn't apply here. And I'm asking you to deal with Verhagen.
Well,
and if you know Edwards, which you might not because it was a criminal case, but it does rely on Verhagen and distinguishes it. And I don't know what provision it came under. But anyhow, it's a broader question. I'm just trying to put all this in focus.
I'm reading 80607, and since under what we've called the bright line rule, parts of 80607 could apply to a small claims action, as Your Honor pointed out. I'm reading under sub 2, where it states that a motion based on 1B shall be made within the time provided in section 80516. 805, that's one reference to 80516, which governs motions after verdict. And that has some time limitations in there. It's a 90-day after judgment. I think there's several issues involved. When we're looking at Verhagen, we're looking at whether there was a new issue raised by the motion to reconsider so that the motion to reconsider itself could be appealed upon. And that never was addressed by the Court of Appeals here. The Court of Appeals never got to the Verhagen issue because the Court of Appeals said 80517 doesn't apply to small claims court, so we don't even get to the issue of whether or not a motion to reconsider is appealable in its own right if it does not or if it does raise new issues that weren't decided by the trial court.
Well, Mr. Silverman, were there any new issues raised by I was just looking through the file, and as I understand what's occurred here, there's a motion for reconsideration referring to 805.17 paren 3. There's a motion to reopen judgment or for relief from judgment referring to 80607.1H. Both of those are handwritten, apparently, by the defendant in this matter. Then there's a typed motion, and that typed motion seems to be one referring to relief from judgment. But everything that's involved in either the handwritten motion or the typed motion seem to refer to the Madison Ordinance in regard to equal opportunities. The rules are attached. The complaint that had been filed with the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission was attached. What was new about this? What was different than what was presented to the judge? It looks like it might have been an expansion of what had been presented to him, but is there anything really new being presented to him?
Your Honor, because that issue isn't before the court, I didn't deeply explore it. I don't know if I'm correct in saying this, because I didn't research it. I think that the motion to reconsider raised for the first time whether or not the mere asking of the question about someone's criminal background, whether that mere asking of the question is a violation of the ordinance. But because I didn't address that, I could be wrong on that. So I don't know if it's a new issue or not, to be fair.
I don't mean to be unfair to you, but my understanding of the facts here is that when Judge DeChambeau made the decision in the first instance, there was a claim that it was improper to penalize the defendant for the fact that she had been convicted of crime. And Judge DeChambeau apparently indicated that wasn't the basis for his ruling. The basis for his ruling was that she had lied on the application. Is that not correct?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. What in my reading of the transcripts, because I wasn't the attorney at that stage, shows that the issue was whether, one issue was whether or not the tenant did actually answer the question. There was a box to be checked. The plaintiff landlord said that she did check it and that she answered no to the question, do you have a criminal background? So the issue that never got addressed by the Court of Appeals is, was there a new issue raised subsequent to that hearing? And I believe that if this court decides this case in the manner that we believe it should be decided, I believe that that issue would need to be addressed by the Court of Appeals. And that's the Verhagen issue. even under the relaxed standard leading up to Edwards, which maybe loosens the test under finding of a new issue or not, that would have to be addressed.
Counsel, what is the issue before the court here today?
The issue today, Your Honor, is does that section apply, and does the bright line rule apply? In other words, the history of Chapter 799, the small claims.
Okay. Is this the issue? Does 805.17 sub 3, which is the reconsideration motion that we've been discussing, apply to evictions which are governed, of course, by 799? Is that the issue?
That would be one framing of the issue.
And then if it does, then was it correctly applied here becomes the sub-issue. If it doesn't, then I suppose we close our files and go home. I don't know. But that seems to me to be the issue, whether or not 805.17.3 has any applicability to evictions actions.
Right. But the broad issue, and the one that really concerns me as a practitioner in small claims court, is if it does not apply using the test that the Court of Appeals used, which is that there's a conflict in the general procedures of Chapter 799, then judges, commissioners, litigants, attorneys would not know which of the general procedural statutes do apply to small claims proceedings and to evictions. Because
I want to follow up on this 80607. Let's say you have a judgment of eviction in small claims court, and you then discover that there was some fraud that was done in obtaining that judgment. What's your avenue of relief?
If there is no provision within Chapter 799 that deals with that ground to bring a motion to reopen or for relief, then the wording in 80607 would apply.
Do you know, is there such a provision?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't think there is.
That ties up the 80607 question that was asked before. One of the grounds for 80607 relief from judgment is if the judgment was fraudulently obtained. And it seems to me that wherever you find that avenue, that there has to be such an avenue. We can't just say, well, okay, there's fraud, but you can only appeal, and you can only appeal on the issues that were the substantive issues that were the basis of the judgment. You've got to have some relief for that. And so that, to me, is an important question. Because if whether or not 80.15.17.3 applies, whether 80.607 applies, except for in default judgments because of the King case.
What Your Honor is getting at is that you simply look at the statute in front of you from the general procedural statutes, and if it is not supplanted or otherwise provided for in Chapter 799, then it applies. And that's because of when you go back to the history of it was 299 before it became 799. The small claims statute is really an exception. It's just an exception to the rules of general procedure. And that is really made, that point is made over and over again by Dean Bowden in both of those articles. And so I agree that that's the way that should be read. And that would mean that the policy of furthering error correction in the trial court is furthered. We don't want to have appeals every time a small claims litigant believes that there was a mistake made by the judge.
Mr. Silverman, I think having read both briefs, your opponent probably would answer the question that was being posed by Justice Bradley by referring to Section 799.28, which has to do with new trials. Is it your position that that is not applicable under the circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, because the wording in 799.28 is a trial after a verdict. This was a trial to the court in this case. 799.28 applies to only trials to the jury, and that is why 805.17 sub 3 is so necessary to be applied to small claims court, because in a trial to the court, you have no other means except for appeal. Or if you bring a motion to reconsider, let's say under some inherent authority of a trial court to reconsider, your time to appeal can go by the wayside while you're either waiting for your motion to be scheduled or for it to be decided. And that's why the mechanism of 805.17 sub 3 is so necessary and useful and promotes the speedy resolution of cases.
Well, now, just to clarify this, and if you are correct that 805.17.3 applies so that either the court on its own motion or a motion or party within 20 days after entry of judgment may amend its findings or conclusions and make additional findings and amend the judgment. If that's true, then when the court does amend the judgment, and you must read amend mean to be revoke or reverse, right? Not only tinkering with it a little bit.
Sorry, my eyes just went to my stoplight. Could you repeat that last question?
When you say amend the judgment, it means you can change the whole judgment, right? Okay. Then it says the time for initiating appeal commences on the entry of the amended judgment. So is it your position that Verhagen, therefore, has no application here because this statute expressly says time for appeal starts at the amended judgment?
Your Honor, I believe that the issues raised by Verhagen and that line of case would still come into play, because all 805.17 sub 3 does is govern when your time to appeal commences. It doesn't address the issue of whether or not it's a new issue that was or could have been decided before.
The whole point in Verhagen, and maybe I've misunderstood it, and the whole point in Edwards is if it's an old issue, then your time for appeal starts at the initial judgment. That's when your time for appeal starts. If it is a new issue, then your time for appeal starts after the motion for reconsideration is decided. So it seems to me, under 805.17.3, it doesn't make any difference whether it's new or old, because the statute itself, and it's really a Supreme Court rule, says the court amends the judgment, the time for initiating it commences on entry of the amended judgment.
I think
if the court denies the motion, the time for initiation of an appeal commences when the court denies the motion, or if it doesn't act, etc.
Your Honor, I think the difference would be whether the appeal is from the judgment or whether it's from a denial of the motion. If it's from a denial of the motion, then the Verhagen line of cases is applicable.
If it's from the denial of the motion.
But if it's from the denial of the judgment, then the issues addressed by those decisions don't come into play, because you're not dealing with a motion decided after a judgment and whether...
Is that what the statute says? Maybe I'm misreading it. It says if the court denies a motion, the time for initiating an appeal from the judgment commences when the court denies the motion of record.
You know, two things can happen in these cases. The moving party can prevail, in which case the other non-moving party would want to appeal and make use of the commencement of the 15 days. Or, of course, the moving party does not prevail, and the moving party could appeal from the judgment, or if the moving party thought that the motion to reconsider raised a new issue, I suppose the moving party could appeal from that too, from the denial of the motion. Or, in the language that Your Honor is citing, that's when the time commences. But the 805.17 sub 3, I don't believe, addresses the issue of what you're appealing from. And I think that's what these other lines of cases.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Representing Highland Manor Associates is David Friedman. Attorney Friedman.
Microphone. Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is David Friedman. I represent Highland Manor Associates, a limited partnership. I'd like to discuss three reasons why the Court of Appeals was right in its analysis that a motion for reconsideration under Section 805.17.3 is incompatible with small claims procedure. Finding that a motion for reconsideration is applicable in small claims procedure would, one, lengthen the process as it impacts both on the workload of the trial courts and on individual litigants. Two, make the process overly complicated. And three, unduly disadvantage the unrepresented party. In the matter before you, as Justice Crooks has pointed out, there was a handwritten motion for a reconsideration, followed by a motion for a stay. 4 days later, filed by an ex parte order asking that the eviction be stayed and relief from judgment with affidavits in support of those motions. Judge Nowakowski held a hearing on those motions, ruling from the bench denying them. Subsequently, Bast asked Judge Nowakowski to reconsider his ruling denying the motion for reconsideration. The parties submitted written statements to the court, and eventually Judge Nowakowski issued a written decision declining to reconsider his ruling on the motion for reconsideration. After Bass filed her notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals, she then filed a motion for an order staying the eviction and for a motion stay pending the appeal. A hearing was held by Judge Nowakowski, after which he issued an order staying the eviction pending the appeal. Bast has presented evidence that in calendar year 2002, 39,123 small claims actions were filed in Milwaukee County. Of those, 11,420 were eviction actions. Can you imagine the burden put on the judges in Milwaukee County, the litigants in the actual cases, and the litigants awaiting trials in the other cases, if the sequence that happened with Michelle Bast would happen in every one of those cases in Milwaukee County?
Well, what's the potential of that? I raised that with opposing counsel. My concern was that if you lost and in an eviction, it would be almost a boilerplate that you'd want to file a motion for reconsideration.
My concern, and I believe I expressed it in the brief, was I'm concerned that if you miss the 15-day timeline for an appeal, file a motion for reconsideration because you've got another 5 days, and we all agree that that's going to reset, or possibly agree that that's going to reset the time. And I think my point is that I think that helps the attorneys, I don't want to say gameplay because I think the rules allow it, but I think that puts the unrepresented party at a disadvantage. They may not know about that where attorneys read the cases and know about it. I think that has the potential to do that and complicate the process for everyone.
Counselor, do you agree that Section 799.28 applies only with trials to a jury?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Why not? It refers back to, 805.15, which speaks only to motions after verdict when you have a trial to a jury. So can you explain that being referenced in the statute, why you think that 799.28 would apply to trials to the court as well?
Two reasons. In the appendix supplied by Bast, the article from Dean Bowden said the procedure of 799 is discouraged trials, discouraged jury trials. So the fact that this is in here could be reconciled with the fact that we understand there are not going to be jury trials. And a layperson looking at this probably doesn't understand the distinction between a trial to the court and a jury trial. One explanation. But two, under 799.28.2, newly discovered evidence, a motion to set aside a verdict or to open a judgment and for a new trial. So if we take the position that Michelle Bast expounds, that new trials are only with a verdict in a jury, then we go to number two, 799.28.2, that talks about a judgment. So for distinguishing between judgments are trial to the court and verdicts are trial with a jury, we have a provision that allows us for newly discovered evidence, which gets at somewhat Judge Bradley's concern about if there is fraud. Now, albeit it's in a 20-day time period, but at least the newly discovered evidence on judgment, this seems to allow it. I'd like to answer Judge Crook's question.
Mr. Friedman, isn't that talk about 799.28.2 talk about a year, up to a year?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
How does that square with your position?
I can't square a lot of the statutes, Your Honor. I've read them, as you have, in some of the same questions you're raising here, I have. I don't know how easily it is to square this. And I think what the result is, you look at this, and you're going to have to make some interpretation as to what is the intent of this statute and how do we rule, and I don't think you're ever going to completely harmonize it. I think there will be issues left for another day, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask this. I want you to respond to Justice Crooks, but let's just hypothetically say, well, if you move for reconsideration, could you also appeal the same? I mean, can they overlap? Or could you appeal first and then move for a new trial?
I think that is the way to do it, Your Honor. You've got 15 days to appeal. It's in two statutes. It's in 799, it's in 808. So we've got 15 days. Move to appeal, do whatever else you have to, and then if there's a quick decision by the court, consolidate. Ask the Court of Appeals to consolidate the matters. It seems to me that way preserves both of it, but I understand that not the most efficient process all the time either, Your Honor.
Well, can you seek a motion for reconsideration in the trial court once you filed on a notice of appeal? I thought that was the end of the trial court.
Well, Your Honor, under 799.28.2, you've got a year to try to overturn the judgment, in essence. And you could have appealed then. And so I don't, quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't know how you do reconcile all of that. I've looked at it, and I don't have a good answer to that question.
What if my motion for reconsideration is made because of fraud?
And you're going under 806.
I'm just asking you. I'm intentionally vague in my question.
If it's newly discovered evidence, then I think.
What do I do if I have a small claims action, judgment of eviction has been entered, I file a motion to reconsider, based on an allegation of fraud, that it was obtained fraudulently for whatever reason? What happens with that?
I'd say 805.17.3 is not applicable. 799.28.2 is.
Even though I denominate it a motion for reconsideration.
Small claims court, I think they don't always stand on formalities. It's designed for lay people to handle. I think, yes.
Okay, so you would want this court, if we go along with you, to say, I don't care if it's denominated motion for reconsideration. You have to look at what the essence, the reason for the reconsideration is. That's what you seem to be saying. Then, huh?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we want you to answer Justice Crooks's question.
And I don't know if this one is in the record in front of the trial court, but Attorney Spears and I stipulated that there was a new issue being raised before Judge Nowakowski that was not raised before Judge DeChambeau. So if you are looking at the Verhagen aspect of it, we stipulated that the detailed analysis that Attorney Spear was asking for was not raised by Attorney Deere in the first hearing before Judge DeChambeau.
So you'd say it overcomes Verhagen, and assuming you overcome everything else, then an appeal is okay here.
If we find the motion for reconsideration to be applicable, Verhagen, I believe, then comes into play, and it is properly before the Court of Appeals.
Okay. Just to clarify your position, counsel, is it that 799.28 sub 1 governing motions for a new trial and small claims actions provided an avenue for the sort of relief that the defendant was seeking in this case?
One of the things that's troubled me is if you say there is no relief under 805.17.3 is, where's the relief come from? And I think you can find that relief in part in 799.28.
Sub 1. Sub 2 is newly discovered evidence, which is not what we've got here.
Correct.
So you're saying that she could have obtained the relief that she was seeking under sub 1, which you construe as pertaining to court trials as well as jury trials? Is that what you're saying?
My argument is based on the fact that Dean Bowden is saying, look, we are trying to discourage jury trials here. And so I don't know that we have to say verdict and judgment are two distinct forms. This is trial to the court.
Well, I understand it, but there are distinct procedures that are applicable to entry of judgment following a jury trial as opposed to a court trial, right? The court trial enters judgment upon the filing of the judge's decision and order, typically, does it not? And in a jury trial, the receipt of the verdict does not effectuate the entry of the judgment. You've got two separate steps in the process and typically a time for filing of motions after verdict.
Your Honor, I've never had a jury trial, so I can't answer from personal experience.
Well, the statutes say so.
No argument.
So why wasn't this just construed as a 799-28-1 motion and allowed to proceed because it was timely filed under that section, if that's what it were construed as, right?
Your question is why can't they proceed under that?
Well, it was filed within that 20-day time period, right?
Correct.
And so, you know, according to your argument, as I understand it, it could be construed as a motion for a new trial, assuming that 799-28-1 applies to both juries and court trials.
And the only reason is that the Court of Appeals said she never actually moved for a new trial. So their position is that it doesn't apply. It was not moved under those. It was moved under 806, which was never argued, and under 805-17-3. And I suppose if we're going to apply the rule, it ought to be prospective and not retroactive.
Can you have a jury trial in an eviction case?
I believe the answer is yes, Your Honor. I don't know that it's ever been, to my experience, it hasn't been done, but I believe it can be done.
Well, it costs money, right? You got to pay the jury fee.
Got to pay the jury fee.
So that's why we don't see a lot of them.
You stay in small claims court or you move over to another division?
I can only speak for Dane County, and I would assume they would set it for trial in front of the judge. The procedure in Dane County is a small claims court commissioner hears the joinder issue, basically. If you don't settle, they set it in trial in front of the judge. And at that point, I would assume that the jury would be involved.
Could I ask, in this case, there was an appeal, obviously. When Michelle Bast appealed, did she have to put up any money or make any commitments, or what goes on here?
Judge Nowakowski did issue an undertaking in which he did not find any monetary costs to be necessary because there's no monetary value in the underlying action, but he did impose conditions on her behavior as part of the order staying the writ of eviction. So that was part of the undertaking for appeal.
So there was no monetary cost to appeal? I would think that in some cases, let's say a party who was unable to pay rent would have difficulty prosecuting an appeal if they couldn't put some money up or meet their financial obligations, but here that didn't happen?
I don't know what Michelle Bast put up for money, Your Honor. I have no idea, but it was not required as part of the undertaking for the appeal.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, you agree that there has to be some mode or avenue of relief.
Yes.
And you find that, apparently, when it's not newly discovered evidence, under 799.28.
Yes.
I look at the very first two sentences of 799.28 and wonder how you get around both the statutory reference and the use of the word verdict. The first sentence with regard to 799.28(1) says motions for new trial in the trial court are governed by 805.15, which deals with jury trials. And, of course, we have in this case a trial to the court. And the next sentence, a motion for a new trial must be made and heard within 20 days after the verdict is rendered, unless the court extends the time as provided, etc. Well, again, this is a trial to the court. The court does not render a verdict in a trial to the court. So both with regard to the statutory reference, which is just to jury trials, and the second sentence, which says that these motions for new trial can be made in a certain time, 20 days after verdict, lead me strongly to believe that this deals with a jury trial. How do you circumvent 805.15 reference and the use of the term verdict? You need to do that in order to get your interpretation.
Two ways. One is, I think that the rule here has been swallowed by the exception. We have so many references in 799 to everything else that I'm not sure when you look at 799.04 that has much validity anymore. So if you take the proposition that what is stated in 799.28 is what ought to be followed, what's written there, I get to it that this is the only thing that comes close. Because this is what is there written. Well, be honest, Your Honor, that's...
No, I laugh because you are so honest. I mean, it isn't the verdict and it isn't a jury trial, but it comes close.
It comes close because under the rule of the expression of one's exclusion of the other, if you buy that 799 should be stated there, and if you find that basically you've eviscerated the general proposition, then there is nothing else. All the questions... One of the issues that I do want to raise to the Court is... What's the time, if 805.17.3 is applicable, what's the time for appealing after that reconsideration motion is decided? Now, I'm not familiar with the criminal case that was decided, but the issue is it 15 days, is it 45 days, or is it 90 days? Typically, in small claims court, there is no entry of judgment given by the parties in an eviction action. It's entered by the clerk. So, because we don't worry about the 21 days notice shortening it to 45, it's a 15-day. I'm not sure what you would have for a time period if this Court would adopt 805.17.3. The Court of Appeals was concerned about the time limits. If on a motion for reconsideration there's no determination and you wait till 90 days, we've added another 90 days. Is the appeal after that the 90-day time period on appeals? Is it the 45 or is it the 15? And because it hasn't been decided, we could run up 200 days after entry of judgment. That goes against the idea that eviction is to be summary, that eviction should be within 15 days. And the more complicated you make the process, when we start raising all these issues, that means we're going to come back to this court, somebody's going to come back to this court, and have those issues decided. If you don't decide them in this case, it complicates the process. We know...
Friedman, can I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure, Your Honor.
As I sit here listening to your argument, I'm somewhat interested in whether or not, when this matter was presented to the Court of Appeals, there was any reference being made to 806.07.1H. Because quite obviously that was another basis, allegedly, for the motion before the trial court for reconsideration.
The Court of Appeals on its own asked the parties to brief the jurisdictional issue, Your Honor, and they raised the motion for reconsideration. As neither party in its initial briefs raised any jurisdictional issues. And as we went through the trial with Judge Nowakowski, the 806 just disappeared. Through nobody bringing it up, and the focus became the motion for reconsideration. And so it just evaporated, for lack of a better term.
Well, do you think 805.17.3 trumps 806.07? I mean, at least there's a shorter time period here in 805.17.3. Maybe the question I started out with, the relation of 805.17 and 806.07, is broader than small claims court.
We've got the Court of Appeals decision saying on default judgments we don't open them. And one of them was the statute, but the other one was also saying, you know, this is what small claims procedure is supposed to be about. And so I don't know the answer to that one, Your Honor, whether it does trump it or not. I don't know how you reconcile it.
Very interesting that the small claims court designed for simple procedures laypersons can use, including representatives of collection agencies,
There seem to be some problems here.
Yes, there are. And we recognize in the small claims procedure that a person employed by an entity can prosecute, commence, and defend an appeal even into the court, even at the appellate level. And that's my concern, is that we, all the questions that are being raised here, we've got seven justices and some attorneys arguing, and we're having trouble coming up with answers. The more complicated you make it, I think it unduly disadvantages the unrepresented party in the small claims action. And I think it allows attorneys to take unfair advantage legally and ethically of people that aren't represented, and that's a concern I have.
Let me summarize what I think I hear you saying, which is broader than for your client, but that your position is that even in small claims court, the court itself and a losing party ought to have some avenue for reconsideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that you suggest, even though the plain language would point otherwise, that 799.281 be that vehicle. It's a fast 20 days. You ask for reconsideration then, or you're out, unless you can do the newly discovered.
And I think there is some credibility for that approach in 799.28 too.
Okay. And then let's just forget 805.17.3 and 806.07 in small claims court, because 799.28, in effect, as you would interpret it, trumps the other two, and that would be in keeping with the whole concept of small claims court, speed, efficiency, yet giving power to the trial court.
By that premise, with respect to 805.17.3, but I haven't thought it through for 806, Your Honor.
Right. But, I mean, that's the essence.
That's the essence of the argument.
What you're arguing.
Yes.
Are you providing a double barrel right here of both 799.28 and an appeal?
And what?
I think you have to, Your Honor. I don't see them as being in conflict. And my concern is if this is a process for lay people, it says you have to appeal within 15 days. Well, the question, what happens if you miss it? Do I get to do a motion for reconsideration or do a new trial or whatever vehicle we find and then extend it? I think for the sake of the efficiency of the justice system that you appeal, because that at least preserves for those people the appeal right. And if the motion, whatever we come up with, is applicable or inapplicable, they still preserve their right to appeal. So I see it as a dual system.
And the delay is really only 20 days for the time of doing it, plus whatever time the court takes. And you assume that will be done from the bench.
Yes.
I hope this isn't too stupid a question. Eviction actions would apply to someone in an apartment, say, or a mobile home. But couldn't that also apply to someone in a business property?
Yes, it could, Your Honor.
Well, suppose someone in a business property hired you. How long could they stay in there, do you think?
If you could convince the judge to issue a stay pending an appeal, they can stay for a long time, depending on how long the appeal takes. So one of the concerns here is that in an eviction action, there's a specific statute that says you're not supposed to stay very long, I believe 30 days. But at the same time, I think the court has equitable power to stay its order, as Judge Nowakowski did, and allow them to stay longer. And so, yeah, the concern here is about holdovers. That's not the facts here, but I see the concern.
And you can prolong an eviction action by an answer, trial. Not easy.
No, in Dane County.
Continuances.
You can
open it up.
Yeah.
I see.
Yes. And I think that's part of the concern. Now, if we have a lengthy appeals process, there's even more delay involved.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Silverman's comment that permitting motion for reconsideration will really, in the whole scheme of things, not cause delays? It will permit resolution when the judge can rethink. How do you respond to that?
I think part of that point is valid and part of it isn't, because in the case before you, it's been stalled up by motion after motion for reconsideration. So, yes, there's a value in having the judge reconsider, but there's also a value in having it done timely, and under 805.17.3, it's no longer timely. It becomes a long period of time when the process is to be a speeded up and expedited process.
Why does it become a long period of time? Because the judge has up to 90 days, is that why you're saying? I mean, most judges in small claims court, if they want to survive, are not going to take things under advisement. I know you have the right to issue written decisions in small claims court. When I was on a trial court, we only for a short period of time did small claims, but the idea of doing a written decision was beyond me. And although perhaps I considered sometimes taking things under advisement, I didn't. So I don't know why that. I mean, okay, you have 90 days, but it's going to be the rare judge and the rare case where you would take the 90 days, I would think.
You may be accurate, but the point is that the time still exists, that it can be done. And if the potential exists, that's the concern we have, is that the potential does exist. Judge Nowakowski found time to issue a written decision saying I'm not going to reconsider my motion for reconsideration. So he obviously took the time to do it because he thought it was worthwhile. I believe that in some cases, judges will do that. Other cases, you're right, I think the judges are just going to orally issue it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Silverman? Closer to your...
How's that? First of all, I want to answer the question posed by Justice Prosser and others, I believe, with regard to whether you can appeal and have a motion to reconsider at the same time. You only can have both if 805.17.3 applies, and that is because of Section 808.075. And I'll read that. And that is in sub 1. In any case, whether or not an appeal is pending, the circuit court may act under, and it cites some sections, and in that string cite is 805.17 sub 3. That is the authority for being able to have the trial court address the matter as well as the Court of Appeals. If we take 805.17 sub 3 away from small claims court, then there cannot be the matter in front of the trial court and the Court of Appeals. The trial court would lose jurisdiction. So that is why, it's just another reason why it's so important that 805.17 sub 3 does apply to small claims.
But doesn't it say, where is it? Doesn't it say 805.15 too?
Find that again. 805.15, which is motions for a new trial after a jury trial, and that's in the general procedure. And so
But that wouldn't be a problem, would it, unless we were to say 799.28 simply is not going to apply to a court trial.
Well, interestingly enough, Your Honor, with regard to 799.28, which Highland Manor seems to be pushing here today, if Highland Manor is concerned with delay, the second sentence under sub 1 in 799.28 allows the court to extend the time as provided in 801.15.2b. That extension is not allowed in 805.17 sub 3. There's no wording that there could be an extension. So if, for some reason, 799.28 were applied to trials to the court instead of the jury, the same question, I believe, would be raised by Highland Manor in that there can be an extension of the time when that motion is heard. And then the reference is made within 799.28 to 805.15, and you would look to 805.15 and 16, because 805.16 governs the time for bringing motions after verdict, and that does require a 90-day time period by which the decision must be made, 90 days after the judgment. So I'm not sure that Highland Manor realized this. The Court of Appeals definitely didn't address this, but 799.28 would itself allow for an extension up to 90 days. But our position has always been that 799.28 applies to new trials after a verdict, and that makes sense when you read it along with 805.15, which it refers to, and 805.16.
Counselor, if I agree with you that 808.075 permits a motion for reconsideration after an appeal has been filed, doesn't that kind of undercut your client's timeliness of the appeal in this case? Because she'd still be obligated to appeal in 15 days. It's just that she could make the motion for reconsideration during that time. So the issue before us is really, is her appeal timely? Doesn't that kind of undercut your argument that her appeal is timely if she could have made a motion for reconsideration after she'd filed her appeal?
I don't think that 808.075, unless I'm missing something, I don't think that would allow in and of itself a motion to reconsider after the 15th day or an appeal after the 15th day.
No, what I'm saying to you is, and I have to tell you, I hadn't thought about it until you brought it up, but under 808.075, it says that these are actions that are permitted pending an appeal, and one of them is an 805.17 sub 3 motion, which is what we've been talking about this afternoon. And I guess as I look at that, I wonder, you know, in a way, perhaps you're both right. Perhaps your client can make that motion, but perhaps Highland Manor is also correct that you still have to have appealed within 15 days of judgment. And if the trial court does something, then you dismiss the appeal, but it doesn't make your appeal timely.
Right. Oh, yes, now I understand
see
the question.
See what I'm saying? And I hadn't really thought about it, but when you bring it up and I see it sitting there looking at me, now, of course, it makes me think about it. So I wonder if you can respond.
I think that because of 808.075, the trial court can reconsider, and assuming that the moving party appeals in a timely manner, the Court of Appeals can also. Or the Court of Appeals might say, we're going to wait and let the trial court reconsider. That's the simplest way, and that's why we've been saying 805.17 sub 3 is actually a simple, less complicated way than having to appeal.
But if we did it in the manner that the appeal time set out in 799, the 15 days, that's it, it really doesn't take away your rights of your client to move for reconsideration of 808.075 can be used during the pendency of the appeal. And if that's the case, just because you made that motion, it doesn't make the appeal timely, does it?
Which was one of Mr. Friedman's arguments, that you've got to do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the resetting of the appeal clock is 805.17 sub 3.
But if you've already, well, all right, okay, I see what you're saying. I just think that this is an interesting thought. But I hadn't had it before, but I will think more about it, I can assure you.
Can I ask this question? Is a motion for a new trial under 808.15, which the small claims code specifically incorporates, a post-judgment or a pre-judgment motion?
That's a post-verdict motion under, was it 805.15. As a post-verdict motion, 805.15 and 805.16 both apply after there had been a trial to the jury. And the section which allows trials to the jury in small claims court is 799.21 sub 4.
Post-verdict pre-judgment. So we don't
have
that. Yes,
right, exactly.
Yet.
That's why there's not the danger of your time to appeal elapsing because you haven't had judgment on the verdict yet.
Is there any kind of a undertaking on a motion for reconsideration?
I don't believe there is a requirement. One thing that I didn't mention is that a motion to reconsider does not stay execution of a writ of restitution. So if a landlord wishes to have the tenant removed by the sheriff, without a stay under, there's a provision 799 that allows for a hardship stay, or without a stay pending appeal, 805.17 sub 3 does not provide a stay of execution. So that's a concern that that a landlord should not have with the application of 805.17 sub 3 to small claims.
Hearing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Silverman. Thank you, Mr. Friedman. And that concludes our hearing on 07-2799 Highland Manor Associates versus Michelle Bast. I see that Mr. Johnson is outside, and I don't know if they want another photo. They're going inside. Okay. We are adjourned for the day, and we will meet in the conference room.